All right, music from Iron and Wine with Serpent Charmer. Animal Song of Sorts sees us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, author-illustrator Ruby Roth, whose new children's book, Vegan is Love, has triggered some controversy and criticism for the book's direct style and sometimes graphic illustrations in addressing such topics as animal testing, circuses, and the way animals are processed for food. Of course, the book has also drawn acclaim for the same reasons. So we'll discuss Vegan is Love, the controversy surrounding, and more when we chat with Ruby Roth in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a Talking Animals coffee mug in which, I'm told, all beverages taste just a little bit better. Also later, we'll have a brief chat with Amber Simpson, one of the organizers of a vegan bake sale happening in Tampa this Friday, May 18th, to benefit some kittens who've been dealt a very tough medical hand and gonna need more treatment and lots of help with some mounting vet bills. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcement segment, a look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events on the horizon, produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department. Our first item, well, basically, quickly, I want to at least say, I hope you all made it to Tropical Heat Wave. If so, did you have fun? Lots of folks still basking in the glow of that great event. I sure am, and seems like people really, really had a great time, though everyone's heat wave experience is almost necessarily different. But anyway, sprawling, bigger and better than ever, and everybody had a fine, fine time. Start off the actual animal news with an alert from the ASPCA. Headline says, military dogs should be adopted, not abandoned. And sort of this, you know, in the past on the show, we've had Dr. Walter Burghardt, who's sort of the leading expert on canine PTSD. And, of course, we've also done shows on the importance of dogs paired with veterans suffering from PTSD. So it comes now, this thing, that each branch of the armed forces uses military working dogs, MWDs, in service to the country. Many of these intelligent, loyal animals serve alongside our soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they prevented countless injuries and saved lives. Unfortunately, these heroic dogs are currently classified as quote-unquote equipment by the U.S. Department of Defense. This classification not only trivializes these animals' contribution, it also makes it difficult to transport dogs serving in foreign lands back to the United States for adoption once they're ready for civilian life. The Canine Members of the Armed Forces Act will remedy this issue by reclassifying MWDs as canine members of the armed forces and instituting programs to assist with their placement in veterinary care after retirement from service, all without using federal funds. This legislation seems like a no-brainer, yet the bill so far has only, I guess, about 7 co-sponsors in the Senate. So need to try to stir up greater support for the Canine Members of the Armed Forces Act in the U.S. Senate. So with that in mind, if you'd like to help out, you can email your 2 U.S. senators in Washington, urge them to co-sponsor the bill. Let's see if we can get this fixed up. Here's something that's made its way around the internet, and of course Facebook, multiple phases, etc. Let's read a little bit of it. For 12 hours, two herds of wild South African elephants slowly made their way through the Zululand bush until they reached the house of late author Lawrence Anthony, the conservationist who saved their lives. The formerly violent rogue elephants, destined to be shot a few years ago as pests, were rescued and rehabilitated by Anthony, who had grown up in the bush and was known as the Elephant Whisperer. For 2 days, the herds loitered at Anthony's rural compound on the vast Thulu Thulu Game Preserve, or reserve, actually, in the South African KwaZulu to say goodbye to the man they loved. But how did they know he had died? Known for his unique ability to calm traumatized elephants, Anthony, to become a legend. He is the author of three books, Babylon Ark, forthcoming The Last Rhinos, and the best-selling The Elephant Whisperer. There are two elephant herds at Thula Thula. According to his son, Dylan, both arrived at the Anthony family compound shortly after Anthony's death. He says they had not visited the house for a year and a half, and it must have taken him about 12 hours to make the journey. Dylan is quoted in various local news accounts. The first herd arrived on Sunday, and the second herd a day later. They all hung around for about 2 days before making their way back into the bush. Elephants have long been known to mourn their own dead, but this was a clear instance of mourning Anthony. So another example of why I love elephants so much. Here's another story making the rounds lately, but just want to make sure you knew about it. Let's read a little bit of this as well. This one, the version from the Digital Journal. The real-life Robinson Crusoe had bought the less than a square mile island in the Seychelles for 8,000 pounds in 1962. In the middle of the Indian Ocean, where he was the only inhabitant, he started making the island inhabitable with the help of a local partner. When he bought Moyen, it was overgrown with scrub so dense that coconuts could not fall to the ground. The island was spectacular, but far from being habitable. To make the dream house come true, he had to harvest rainwater, etc. And now, it flaunts 16,000 trees, attracting thousands of birds and a huge community of giant tortoises, which were being killed off on other islands. So Grimshaw lives alone, Brendan Grimshaw is the guy's name, with 120 giant tortoises that are free to roam anywhere and everywhere all the time. And he has a way to sort of track them and identify them. And anyways, it's a great, great story, and some great pictures that go some versions of that online. Closer to home here on this Saturday, May 19th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., there's going to be a multi-rescue adoption event at Royal Pets Market and Resort in Carrollwood. And there'll be three rescue groups involved, Cat Crusaders, Pet Pal Inc., and Florida Big Dog Rescue. So it'll be puppies, kittens, and other vintages of those animals probably. And this, again, is at Royal Pets Market and Resort, 16010 Maple Dale Boulevard in Carrollwood. And that's, again, this Saturday, May 19th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. This is from AP, Dateline Honolulu. The U.S. Navy says its use of sonar and explosives could potentially hurt more dolphins and whales in Hawaii and California waters than previously thought. The new research and more thorough analysis are part of an environmental impact statement covering Navy training and testing planned for 2014 through 2018. The Navy estimates its use of explosive and sonar may unintentionally cause more than 1,600 instances of hearing loss or other injury to marine mammals in 1 year. Its use of explosive may inadvertently cause more than 200 marine mammal deaths a year. The old analysis, covering 2009 through 2013, estimated the service might unintentionally injure or kill about 100 marine mammals. The Navy says the actual numbers would be lower than these newer estimates because it will take steps to prevent harm to the animals. And also a little bulletin from our old friend, Dr. Michael Greger, past guest on Talking Animals. He says here, I'm excited to announce that yet another new volume, my latest in nutrition DVD series, is now available for pre-order and will ship out Monday, May 21st. As always, he notes, all proceeds from the sale of the DVDs go to charity. You can order them through Amazon, etc. Normally, he says, I come out with just one volume a year. They each cover different topics, but to fulfill my promise of uploading a new video every weekday year-round to nutritionfacts.org, I've had to step it up. So, as usual, he's scoured the world's scholarly literature on clinical nutrition for the most interesting, practical, and groundbreaking discoveries published over the last 12 months on how best to feed ourselves and our families to prevent, treat, and even reverse chronic disease. So, in this edition, just random, read a few of the entries here. Which brand of tuna has the most mercury? Pharmacists versus health food store employees. Who gives better advice? Some dietary supplements may be more than a waste of money. Blocking the first step of heart disease, and so on. So you can find out more about the DVDs and order them by going to Dr. Greger, GREGER.org/DVDs. And, of course, you can watch all the videos and the things that gets uploaded, a new one every day, by going to nutritionfacts.org. www.thebeatles.org. All right, we've got a few more things that we may have time for when we come back later in the show to this. Right now, though, I think that we'll step into the comedy corner, which involves animal comedy. And as always, this is the wonderful Jim Gaffigan with the other half of his great new piece on whales. I had played the first half a few weeks ago. So now this is Jim Gaffigan with sort of part two of a piece called Whales on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I do love whales. I don't want you to get the wrong idea. But it's not like there are people that are anti-whale anyway. You know, it's like, oh, don't bring up whales around my dad. He'll go off. Damn whales are all fat and lazy. Living off the government. Taking our jobs. Blah, 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 blah. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, 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 blah. Whales must have poor body image. Can you imagine having a part of your body called a blowhole? And it's on top of your head? You think when whales get older, they have less control over their blowhole? They're just in the middle of a normal conversation. What do you say? You and I grab some plankton. Excuse me. This is so embarrassing. I was just in the Indian Ocean and my stomach really can't handle that. The old whale geography diarrhea joke. Coming in handy. You always hear number one killer of whales, mankind. You know, as if there's tons of competition. Let's take a look at the leaderboard of whale killers. Still number one, mankind. Number two, the pelican with the machine gun. And a distant third, the lion on a jet ski. Back to you, Bill.
All right, Jim Gaffigan with the second half of a piece called Whales from his new comedy special, Mr. Universe, which like Louis C.K. famously did with his latest special, is available only on Jim's website, jimgaffigan.com, as a download. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Ruby Roth. As I noted earlier in the show, Ruby is an author-illustrator whose new children's book, Vegan is Love, has triggered some controversy and criticism for the book's direct style and sometimes graphic illustrations, and generated plenty of applause for the same reason. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org, let's welcome Ruby Roth to Talking Animals. Good morning, Ruby.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Sure.
So, there's just tons and tons I want to discuss with you, and I doubt we'll get it all in, but let's do our best. And actually, I think it'd be nice to sort of start off with getting a little bit acquainted with you. Let's do something of a kind of a meet and greet with Ruby, if you will. Just tell us a little bit about yourself. I know I'm talking to you in Southern California now. Is that where you grew up, or where did you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up here down in L.A., lived in Hawaii on an organic tree farm, lived in Santa Cruz, went to school there, and then the Bay Area as well, and back down to L.A.
Wow, okay, well, that's a cool cool circuit. And where in Kauai? I mean, was it in Kauai, I want to say, based on what you just...
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
North Shore of Kauai.
Nice, all right, cool. So what role during those years and sort of making the rounds there, what role did animals play in your family? I mean, sort of growing up in particular, what was that like in your household?
Well, like most kids, I think I loved animals, period.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. My mom was a vegetarian my entire life. Growing up on the organic farm gave me a great appreciation for nature.
Mm-hmm.
I was not vegan. I was a meat eater during my childhood. But everything in my life, I think, pointed to me going vegan, from my mom to living with vegan roommates in one of the meccas of veganism, Santa Cruz.
Sure.
To my grandparents' survival of the Holocaust. I think that gave me a very clear sensitivity towards oppression and what that means.
Hmm.
But I didn't come into the idea that I would adopt veganism for myself until I was in my 20s.
Yeah. Well, let's well, we've got that storyline starting. Let's also look at the storyline that probably at least is crucial for our purposes today, which is your sort of interest and then development in art and then becoming an artist. Now, is that something that similarly happened you know, quite young, or was that something you kind of later came
yes,
to?
Yes, that was from childhood on. I was interested in art and taking art classes. I knew that was going to be part of my life.
Right.
I was also interested in justice and politics and majored in both in college.
Wow, cool. So so just to back up for a sec, so early on, what sort of art were you both drawn to particularly, and then perhaps on a related note, what sort of art did you find yourself when you were really starting to develop your own kind of inclinations as an artist? What kinds of work were you doing in particular?
Well, when I look back on the scrapbooks my mom keeps, there was a lot of animal drawings, but I think that's common mm-hmm. to most kids. We mm-hmm. have an inherent curiosity and love for animals. And as I grew up, I was very interested in classical figure drawing, always taking figure drawing classes at local schools. And
yeah.
I really have an appreciation for the masters.
Cool. All right, so we've got like the animal thing, we've got the art thing. Now, to me, there let's sort of see where they merge for what we'll mostly be talking about today. I mean, to me, there are so many things that are interesting about the whole controversy that's unfolded around veganism love, starting with the fact that it's not your first children's book about veganism.
Right.
Let's get into that one a little bit. Describe what prompted you to write that first one called That's Why We Don't Eat Animals, and tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was teaching art at an elementary school, and the kids were always really curious about why I wasn't eating the string cheese and the milk that they were being served mm-hmm. at recess. And, you know, at first I was a little bit scared of talking about my veganism, but I did it anyway. And I was shocked to hear just how interested they were in healthy eating and foods and what was going on with animals and what they could do, what anybody could do at any moment to make choices to protect animals.
Sure.
So I went to look for a book that I could bring in to talk more about it. But everything that I found was about a talking animal or a talking vegetable. And these kids were just too cool for school. And I didn't think that would catch their attention.
Hmm.
So with my background in art and American studies, I decided to create the book myself.
Wow, that's very cool. And of course, we're very biased towards talking animals here at this show. But so just to back up for a sec, though, it's really interesting that as you're recounting that, one of the things you said before it sort of worked out okay is that you were a little bit, you know, uneasy or even scared to talk with the kids about your veganism. Why was that?
Well, I think we know just from seeing the controversy of my second book coming out that there's a fear and an unfamiliarity with a plant-based diet, even though throughout history in the world, nations of people have survived and thrived on plant-based diet. There's a lot of questions that come up, and I think what people don't realize is what we're talking about when we talk about veganism is not the standard American diet minus meat and dairy, but an entirely new pyramid that is by far more nutrient-dense, whose nutrients are more bioavailable to us, and the nutrients are free from harmful side effects. So I could understand the questions and the fear that most parents would have if a child came home and said they didn't want to eat meat or dairy anymore.
That crazy Miss Roth is putting nutty ideas in our head, right?
But I was in the position of teaching.
Yeah.
And I thought if kids have questions, they should have answers. And really, if any parent had questions, there were answers to any of those questions as well.
Sure, Sure. So really, yeah, so that was really what prompted that first book was they did have questions. You were looking for some way to kind of present it. And what sort of class level or age range were these kids?
I was teaching elementary school. It was first grade to fifth graders. Mm-hmm. I found the third, fourth, and fifth graders were the real ones that were really eager to engage in the conversation.
Sure, sure. Well, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. If you just tune in, we're talking with author-illustrator Ruby Roth, whose new children's book is Vegan is Love. If you'd like to ask Ruby a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So maybe I missed it, but what sort of hubbub was there surrounding the first book, That's Why We Don't Eat Animals?
Well, that one received a tremendous amount of support, too, and definitely found its people around the world. But there was critiques from, you know, comments on articles mm-hmm. to actual opposition from the meat and dairy industries themselves. The CEO of the Farm Bureau in Utah had a lot to say about it.
It just didn't feel, I mean, even trying to go back and think, God, did I miss something? It just didn't feel as kind of seismic as what's happened in the wake of the second book.
No, this one, I think, especially because vegan is in the title
mm-hmm.
and love is in the title.
Sure.
It gets both sides really fired up.
And
vegans are supportive of everything vegan and, meat eaters are quite interested in this conversation.
Sure. So that brings us maybe to an important question is in setting out to create the book, the new book, what was your approach? I mean, for example, you know, the title, as you say, kind of, you know, has sort of a double barrel kind of a way to sort of grab people's interest and stir up controversy. I mean, how much of that right off the bat was sort of designed to provoke that kind of response?
Well, I wrote this book primarily for vegan families, so I didn't write it with the intent of sparking the controversy. Mm-hmm. But the title, Vegan is Love, was chosen because I feel that veganism is an embodiment of love and a commitment to the well-being of others. And that's not to say that meat eaters don't love or aren't worthy of love, but I think there's a willful ignorance there about our role in the abuse and destruction that we inflict on animals and the environment. And there's studies, there was a study recently that showed that children, vegan and vegetarian children, are not judgmental of their peers who do eat animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, which is pretty interesting. Yeah.
Adults forget what it's like to think like a child.
Yeah, well, because definitely one of the storylines here is more than a little judgmental kind of reaction on the part of the adult type folks here. So when you were writing Vegan is Love, I mean, what were some of the ways it differed, you know, in your approach to the first book?
Well, the first book is really about the why
mm-hmm.
of
yeah.
Plant-based diet. It's
right.
about the emotional lives of animals and factory farming, the environment,
right.
and endangered species. The second book is really about the how. How in our everyday lives can we make choices to improve the lives of animals, our own health, the environment, and people around the world.
And were there, as you were writing it, were there sections you wrote or rewrote to make a certain point or achieve a certain philosophical kind of element to it?
Well, I wanted to include all the major tenets
mm-hmm.
of veganism, and that spans from pollution to the environment to health to animals. I mean, there's a wide range of motives for people in the vegan community.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of research from zoology to politics to economics. I mean, at the core of this book, it's really about democracy, supply and demand, and engaging ourselves in the public realm. So I drew on all kinds of sources
sure.
to write this book.
And So, but as you were writing it, I'd just be curious to know, just in light of some of the things we've already kind of covered and sort of, you know, what sounds like, maybe slightly bemused on your part about kind of, you know, what happened and the reaction it generated, especially in contrast maybe to some degree to the first book. You know, like for example, one passage that's been cited as part of this whole sort of controversy slash criticism is, under the Do No Harm section, it says at one point, whether they live in the sunshine or in a dark shed, all animals raised for meat and dairy are captured and killed in the inn. Their deaths are violent and sad. So, you know, did it, you know, as you were writing that, you just felt like, hey, you know, that's I just don't want to be any less direct than that, even though I think this is, if I'm not mistaken, this book is aimed at readers like sort of six and up, second grade and up.
Yes, that's yeah. Seven and up is official.
Okay.
Well, that spread in particular, let me say a couple of things.
Sure.
One, between my first book and second book, I've seen both a growth in the vegan population, but also a growth in people who think that switching over to quote-unquote humanely raised or organic or grass-fed animals makes a huge difference. And really, that may make a difference in our consciences, but it doesn't make a difference to the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these animals are slaughtered in USDA slaughterhouses, so they all end up in the same place. There's nothing untrue about what I say mm-hmm. on that page, and that I say that it's sad and violent. I think that this controversy has really proven that people know on a level that what we do to animals is scary and sad. Otherwise, there wouldn't be this controversy.
Yeah.
If it's too scary to talk about it, then I think it's too scary to eat.
Right. And I was going to ask you about this at some point anyways, but this might be as good a time as any. I imagine you probably saw the recent essay contest in the New York Times Magazine in the ethicist section. So, and just for people listening who maybe didn't, basically the question posed was, is it ethical to eat meat? And then they sort of opened it up for people to write, I think, maximum 600-word essays, and they thought they'd get a few dozen or even a few hundred, and they ended up getting like 3,000. So obviously this is something very much on people's minds for it to trigger that kind of response. I'd be curious to know what your response was to initially the sort of premise and then some of the responses that it generated, at least that we know about.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, the word sustainable has really been co-opted in a negative way, in my opinion, especially in the last few years as people become more eco-conscious. Companies like Monsanto and meat and dairy industries and even fast food restaurants have become more cognizant about how they can market themselves to people who just really want to feel better or not as guilty about the abuse and destruction they're taking part in.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen that word in Monsanto ads. I've seen that word in fast food ads. I think that this idea of looking for ethical motives is just really an excuse that allows people to justify not changing,
mm-hmm.
not making any sacrifices on behalf of the greater good of all living beings.
Yeah. And at the same time, I guess one of the things I was struck by in terms of this this contest is that at least the sampling that readers were provided, and again, they got, you know, just, I think 3,000 or some in that. I think there was, you know, a chance for readers to kind of weigh in with, you know, just sort of in a response to a poll. And I know there's quite a bit of comments with that. But I mean, it did reflect something that you kind of mentioned just a bit ago, yourself, which is that there really has been, this is another way to kind of measure it in some way, a real shift in, you know, the way people sort of think about and in many ways, now have embraced on a larger scale, vegan living.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to be vegan to make vegan choices. These are choices that anybody and everybody can make at any given moment of life. And I think that given the environmental and health crises we find ourselves in America, it really goes to show that it's going to be up to the people to make the change. We don't have to wait to grow older or for laws to change or for presidents to be elected. As I say in my book, we can begin right now.
Sure. And kind of with that in mind, I guess I'd be curious to what extent, you know, have you found this controversy sort of a welcome development? I mean, as an activist, you have the opportunity to address some issues you're obviously very passionate about on platforms like CNN, Today Show, et cetera. And, you know, of course, just on a more fundamental level as an author, something like this probably, you know, can't help but, I would hope or think, you know, boost book sales. But mainly it's just an opportunity to talk more about these issues in a sort of a wider forum.
Yeah, I felt an immense gratitude, kind of overwhelmingly emotional after being able to speak on behalf of animals on a national level.
Yeah.
That was very moving to me. I mean, book sales, that's great. You know, I'd probably make more money if I were a 12-year-old babysitter, you know. But just the fact that we can have this discussion on a national level. And when I was a child, I don't think I knew of the existence of the word vegan.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, in a relatively short time later, people know the word enough to argue about it. So
sure.
Well, we're on the right path.
Right. And as part of that, I'd be really curious to talk to you a little bit, just for a moment or two, at least about the media coverage itself, or at least some of it, because as something of a media junkie, you know, I'm just fascinated by the way, you know, media, more mass media, like, you know, with editors and producers and safeguards than necessarily like bloggers or YouTubers or whatever that have, mm-hmm. you know, so none of those things in place, how they cover a story and people and sort of what tone and attitudes kind of revealed either explicitly or implicitly. For example, you know, the CNN thing to me at least seemed pretty straightforward in terms of interviewing you and talking about the book.
Well, that anchor, by the way, is vegetarian. I don't know how much she talks about it, but
Okay. Well, that may cook, because I thought by contrast, the Today Show, back to a word that came up earlier, to me felt more judgmental and sort of finger wagging. And I think they even labeled it, or I don't remember if they said this or this was like a Chiron thing on the screen, but extreme parenting, I think was the phrase that came up. So maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, one or both of those or any other, you know, media experiences you've had and just kind of how those things seem to, play out and what they may or may not reveal about, you know, those entities or just some of the journalists.
Well, originally with the Today Show, they were going to have me in studio, and that kind of changed at the last minute. And I wasn't really surprised about that, because you look at who their sponsors and advertisers are. And I really don't know how much they can say. I think it's really interesting that the media always feels they have to represent the other side of my argument, when really veganism is the other side. I mean, I think if the American public knew the level of disease and abuse in the meat and dairy industries, or really any commerce involving animals, then the outrage would really be directed at the industries, not a children's book about choices, alternative,
mm-hmm. yeah.
to the status quo. So it's been interesting. I mean, they have to make a story out of it.
Yeah.
But I think there's no reason why they couldn't have had a vegan nutritionist to get, you know, the whole picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. It does seem like you say that maybe that was the case. Of course, I didn't know that it was supposed to be an in-studio thing and it got shifted around. But yeah, I guess it's just one of those things like, hey, this subversive, children's book author, let's keep in mind, who's advertising and what the implications that might have, I guess, for, the mighty, and once mighty, I guess, Today Show. But anyway, I just thought that was really, you know, sort of interesting in so many ways. Just like, it didn't even take much reading between the lines. I mean, again, with the some of the things that just came right out and said, I just thought that really was probably more revealing than they intended. But let's get a couple of questions from emailers or others here. One says, Dear Ruby, thank you so much for the work you're doing. This is so important. School lunches are generally a disaster nutritionally, and there are so many myths about kids and veganism. Do you do talks to parent groups about kids' health?
I do. I've spoken to many groups, been on many panels. If people are interested, that they can email me through wedonteatanimals.com.
Right. I should say that's the your website, and that, of course, was the name of the first book, but that's also where people can get more information and see some other information and clips, and, I think, from the CNN appearance and some other things. So that has a lot of stuff. And then there's also Facebook pages devoted to that as well. All right, let's see also. Let's take a caller. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ruby Roth.
Hi, my name's Sam. I just have a question. You know, I'm a vegetarian.
Okay.
I actually have two questions.
Okay.
But, you know, one of the reasons why I haven't made the switch to being a vegan is because I have a strong belief about amino acids, and I have a hard time getting those through a plant-based diet. Also, one of the things that's always been looming, and, you know, I know people that hunt hogs in the wild, and they, you know, they're always saying, well, if we just let these animals go, they're going to overrun the world, you know, and that's one of the questions that I myself have about it, even being a vegetarian, you know, is how would we control that? And I think a lot of people think about that. So I'll hang up and let you answer this.
Okay, so we want to talk about how to address the amino acids issue and also about hunting in terms of animal population control, correct?
Yeah, overpopulation.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay, thanks so much for your question. Go ahead,
okay,
Ruby.
Well, with proteins, which is the catch-all name for amino acids, what we're really looking for are amino acids in foods, and they're not solely inherent to animal products, but they're in every food, and all fruits and vegetables have the range of essential amino acids. The levels differ, but I was just looking at the amino acid profile of broccoli last night, and in one stalk of broccoli, you're getting a sufficient amount of all the essential amino acids. So these nutrients are not only superior in quality in the vegan pyramid, but they're also more bioavailable, which means we absorb them, our body recognizes them easier, and they come free of harmful side effects that meat and dairy cause.
Okay, so, cool. I think that, yeah, and again, I think, you know, that's just one example of how, you know, that is the question that almost inevitably comes up first, like, hey, how do you get your protein? How do you get enough protein? And the broccoli example sounds like just one great instance of that there's really no shortage of getting sufficient protein.
Yeah, any myths about deficiencies have been long disproven by the nations of people who throughout history have thrived and survived on a plant-based diet. There's no problem getting amino acids in the vegan pyramid.
Cool.
And so secondly, to his question about overpopulation. I have that question a lot. Well, what's going to happen with all of these animals if we shut down the factory farms? And the answer is we're raising 65 billion animals around the world for meat and dairy every single year. So it's a question of putting an end to the breeding and the continued propagation of these animals. Nature takes care of itself with population and overpopulation in the animal kingdom. And what's going on when you have hunting permits and populations of animals that you have to go through the system to be able to hunt for, there's all kinds of corruption in those systems. You just have to scratch the surface to see what's going on with the agencies that allow us to hunt animals under the name of, well, then, you know, we're doing our part to keep population down. If you look into the parks and recreations, you just, like I said, only have to scratch the surface to see what's going on.
Right, and we should note that, of course, the book, not surprisingly, includes a section on hunting and many, many other things. And I was you know, kind of pleased to see that there's a section as well about racing both horse and dog, since we're speaking from an area where there's still a lot of dog racing going on. So Yeah. So again, it's pretty, it's really kind of cool and comprehensive, but again, some beautiful, beautiful illustrations by Ruby. So Ruby, we have maybe just a minute or less left. One thing I was just going to ask you just on a more general note, just because, you know, Maurice Sendak died last Tuesday, and obviously sort of a towering figure in your field. Just any thoughts on Sendak you'd like to share?
Well, one of the interesting things that has happened since then in the last week is my name has been mentioned a couple of times in articles about Maurice Sendak, and it's been a critical mentioning, saying that we love Where the Wild Things Are because it was simple and it wasn't preachy, unlike books like Vegan is Love.
Mm.
But I think people don't really know about the life and work of Maurice Sendak, and Where the Wild Things Are is genius and it's amazing, but it's also quite dark.
Yeah.
And a lot of his work was dark and not politically correct. And as he said himself many times, he refuses to lie to children and sugarcoat everything. So
right.
I believe he would appreciate a book like Vegan is Love. And I think he was one of the greatest artists and storytellers in the industry, and probably ever will be in the industry, and I appreciate his career immensely.
Right, and I kind of suspect you might feel that way. And again, I thought philosophically, you and Maurice Sendak, you know, are much more aligned than people might initially thought. That's another reason I wanted to ask you about him. So a great answer, and that's probably the perfect place at which to leave our conversation. So again, we've been speaking with Ruby Roth. Her new book is Vegan is Love, Having Heart and Taking Action. And you can get that anywhere that you get books, or children's books at least in particular. And again, her website is WeDon'tEatAnimals.com, and there's a Facebook presence for those things as well. So Ruby, thanks again for joining us on Talking Animals. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. All right, it's time now to get into Name That Animal Tune. We have a giveaway. This is a giveaway. You do not need to be a WMF member to win. There'll be a prize. The winner will receive a Talking Animals coffee mug to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune. In a moment, we'll speak with Amber Simpson about the vegan bake sale slated for Friday in Tampa to help some kittens that are having a tough, tough go. Meanwhile, it's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. Take a quick guess. Hi, can you name that animal tune?
Great Little Bird.
That's right. That is right, sir. What is your first name?
Sam. This is Sam again.
Oh, okay, Sam. Well, I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll come back and figure out what to do. And but thanks for listening, and you are correct, sir. It is Three Little Birds by Bob Marley.
Thank you,
okay,
Duncan.
Thanks
thank
a lot,
you.
Man. Okay, folks, we do have a winner, and more to the point, we have on the line with us now Amber Simpson. Good morning, Amber.
Hello, Duncan. How are you?
I'm really great. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. And let's jump right into, I've kind of made a couple of references to these kittens, but tell us more specifically about these kittens that the bake sale is going to aim to help out.
Well, it's to help three kittens, Jubilee, Jasper, and Squeakers. They were found on the streets of Tampa when they were about 2 weeks old. So they were bottle babies from the get-go, and they already had upper respiratory, very sick. And then they went into pneumonia. So they've had a hard start at life right from the get-go.
I'll say. And so Amber, I assume they were out on the street, so these were ferals that were just kind of...
Yeah, born to feral moms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of volunteers do the TNR, the trap, neuter, return for feral cats. And that's
yeah.
how we find a lot of these babies that are in need.
Sure. And how did you in particular hear about these kittens and get involved in trying to help them?
I helped Janine from Cat Crusaders out a lot with transports and doing TNR and everything like that. And mm-hmm. She had contacted me asking for my help on organizing a vegan bake sale to raise some money to help with the vet bills for these kittens. So, of course, I didn't hesitate.
Sure. And are these kinds of medical issues that these little kittens are experiencing, is that common or uncommon relative to feral, you know, cats born to feral moms like that?
Upper respiratory is very common. Going into pneumonia is not. So, unfortunately, they had a stroke of bad luck. So they actually had to be in an incubator. They are in their foster home now. So they are.
Oh, good.
Yes. So they are not at the vet any longer. One of them is still touch and go as far as we don't know if he will be able to see out of both eyes. One of his eyes has a problem. So everybody's still monitoring him to see if he'll be able to see again.
Okay. But it already sounds like, you know, generally good progress, because
yes.
I think last I knew they were still kind of really, you know, needing oxygen and were very sort of closely supervised by the Met sort of, you know, hour by hour. So that's...
Yes,
that's
so everything's looking up now.
Okay, so their prospects for making it sounds like they really increased. So the one, we hope the eye situation, you know, turns out good. But and then will these cats, as far as you would know based on your experience, continue to have kind of special needs as they grow older? Or obviously the one with the eye is questionable now, but I mean just generally kind of with the rough start they had, will they be okay, or will they always be a bit you know, up against it?
No, they'll be fine after they recover, with the exception if the one has, you know, an eye problem. You know, he may be blind in one of his eyes, but with the exception of that, as soon as they recover, just like if a person, you know, catches a cold or catches pneumonia and they recover,
okay.
They're generally okay from that point.
Okay.
Well, they will be up for adoption after they get well.
Oh, good. Okay, well, good. So then we can kind of hit a couple of points here, because one is the vegan bake sale. Why don't you give us the details of where and when and how that works?
Okay, it's going to be this Friday, May 18th, from 5 o'clock to 7:30 p.m. at Animal Based Charities Thrift Store, and that is at 4342 South Manhattan Avenue in Tampa. 100% of the proceeds of the bake sale will go directly to help these kittens. And then 50% of the thrift store sales for the night will go specifically to help these kittens as well. And then, as always, the other 50% will also go to help animals, because Animal-Based Charities Thrift Store is 100% to help the animals.
Right. So it's all going to animals, whatever you do.
Yes.
And but 50% specifically is earmarked to help these little kitties that we're talking about.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So, and then if folks can't attend, let's say, you know, they just have other plans, they can't make it over Friday between, you know, 5 and 7:30, are there other ways that people could help out?
Yes. If they wanted to make a donation, they could go to TampaCatCrusaders.org. And on the right-hand side, there's a PayPal button. They could donate through there. And they could also click around and see more volunteer opportunities if they want to get, you know, more involved in helping other cats and kittens as well.
Cool.
You could also go to meetup.com/animal advocacy of Tampa Bay, which is a great site with all of the animal events in the area. And right now on the front page is the flyer for this bake sale, and some other close-up pictures of the kittens and more information and contacts and things like that. So
cool.
That's meetup.com/animal advocacy of Tampa Bay.
Great. And I should say that yesterday, just in sort of checking this out and trying to get a little prepared for today, I did go to the site. I did go to the PayPal part, and I donated, and it was you know, very quick and easy, the way most PayPal transactions are. So you know, that's another way you can help these guys out, and there's other opportunities, as Amber noted. And then also, it sounds like at some point there'll be an opportunity to adopt one or more of these kitties.
Yeah, if anyone's interested in adopting one of the three, they can also contact Cat Crusaders via the website.
Okay.
But if they would like to adopt a healthy kitten now, there's actually a big adoption event this Saturday from 11 to 3, so that's Saturday, May 19th, at Royal Pet Market and Resort, which is in Carrollwood. It's 16010 Maple Dell Boulevard in Carrollwood, so all of the healthy cats and kittens from Cat Crusaders will be there looking for Forever Home.
That's great. Yeah, we mentioned that in the first part of the show, but it's great to give them another mention. And again, just one more time, I want to say that for people who do want to either help out by donating or find out more, just generally about, these efforts, you can go to TampaCatCrusaders.org. And then once you're on the website, just over on the right-hand side, there's the PayPal link. And if you are going to donate, it's probably good or helpful if you could write sick kittens in that memo line just so they know specifically that that's what it's intended for. So, well, Amber, I hope the vegan bake sale is a great success. And I hope otherwise if people, again, can't make it over, they might help out by donating if they can, volunteering if they can, whatever they can do to help these and or other kittens and cats. So.
Yes, thank you so much, and thank you for donating, Duncan. That'll help a lot.
Absolutely. All right, well, hopefully we're leading by example here. We'll see. But anyways, Amber, well, thanks again for all your great efforts, and again, good luck with Friday's bake sale.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
All right, we've just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, May 23rd, when our guest will be Bob Tart, the author of Rye, sometimes very funny books chronicling the adventures and misadventures of various animals who live inside and outside the West Michigan house. He shares with his wife, Linda. His new book is called Kitty Cornered, speaking of cats and all things cat-related, so I hope you'll join me next week for that. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page or Twitter feed and more. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby Busalis. My thanks to her, especially because she's even doing more right now. More on that eventually. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And coming up next is the terrific afternoon. I'll tell you about in a moment of music. But if you want to keep listening to Public Affairs, Tom Hartman's show is starting up at noon on 88.5 HD3 online at WMNF.org/thesource. But if we're looking for music, you came to the right place right here. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. And well, we'll hear a little bit of this. We're closing out today's show as always with an animal tune. This one by an act that played Tropical Heat Wave again on Saturday. This is Jubal's Kin with Cuckoo Bird, taking us right up to the NPR News on WMNF Tampa. Speak again next Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Pretty bird as she goes waltzing by. Oh, cuckoo, she's a pretty bird as she wobbles, as she flies, and she'll cause you never more trouble.